Chapter 7, Dissension between Theophilus, Bishop of Alexandria, and the Monks of the Desert. Condemnation of Origen's books. The question had been started a little before, one, whether God is a corporeal existence, and has the form of man, or whether he is incorporeal, and without human or, generally speaking, any other bodily shape. From this question arose strifes and contentions among a very great number of persons, some favoring one opinion on the subject, and others patronizing the opposite. Very many of the more simple ascetics asserted that God is corporeal, and has a human figure, but most others condemn their judgment, and contended that God is incorporeal, and free of all form whatever. With these latter Theophilus, Bishop of Alexandria, agreed so thoroughly that in the church before all the people he inveighed against those who attributed to God a human form, expressly teaching that the divine being is wholly incorporeal. When the Egyptian ascetics were apprised of this, they left their monasteries and came to Alexandria, where they excited a tumult against the bishop, accusing him of impiety, and threatening to put him to death. Theophilus, becoming aware of his danger, after some consideration had recourse to this expedient to extricate himself from the threatened death. Going to the monks, he in a conciliatory tone thus addressed them: "In seeing you, I behold the face of God." The utterance of this saying moderated the fury of these men, and they replied, "If you really admit that God's countenance is such as ours, anathematize Origen's book." Two, for some drawing arguments from them, oppose themselves to our opinion. "If you will not do this, expect to be treated by us as an impious person, and the enemy of God." "But as far as I am concerned," said Theophilus, "I will readily do what you require, and be ye not angry with me, for I myself also disapprove of Origen's works, and consider those who countenance them deserving of censure." Thus he succeeded in appeasing and sending away the monks at that time, and probably the whole dispute respecting this subject would have been set at rest, had it not been for another circumstance which happened immediately after. Over the monasteries in Egypt there were four devout persons as superintendents, named Dioscorus, Ammonius, Eusebius, and Euthymius. These men were brothers, and had the appellation of the tall monks given them on account of their stature. They were moreover distinguished both for the sanctity of their lives, and the extent of their erudition, and for these reasons their reputation was very high at Alexandria. Theophilus in particular, the prelate of that city, loved and honored them exceedingly, insomuch that he constituted one of them, Dioscorus, bishop of Hermopolis III, against his will, having forcibly drawn him from his retreat. Two of the others he entreated to continue with him, and with difficulty prevailed upon them to do so. Still, by the exercise of his authority as bishop, he accomplished his purpose. When, therefore, he had invested them with the clerical office, he committed to their charge the management of ecclesiastical affairs. They, constrained by necessity, performed the duties thus imposed on them successfully. Nevertheless, they were dissatisfied because they were unable to follow philosophical pursuits and ascetic exercises. And as in process of time, they thought they were being spiritually injured, observing the bishop to be devoted to gain, and greedily intent on the acquisition of wealth, and according to the common saying, leaving no stone unturned for the sake of gain, they refused to remain with him any longer, declaring that they loved solitude, and greatly preferred it to living in the city. As long as he was ignorant of the true motive for their departure, he earnestly begged them to abide with him, but when he perceived that they were dissatisfied with his conduct, he became excessively irritated, and threatened to do them all kinds of mischief. But they, making little account of his menaces, retired into the desert, upon which Theophilus, who was evidently of a hasty and malignant temperament, raised not a small clamor against them, and by every contrivance earnestly sought to do them injury. He also conceived a dislike against their brother Dioscorus, bishop of Hermopolis. He was moreover extremely annoyed at the esteem and veneration in which he was held by the ascetics, being aware, however, that he would be able to do no harm to these persons unless he could stir up hostility in the minds of the monks against them. He used this artifice to effect it. He well knew that these men, in their frequent theological discussions with him, had maintained that the deity was incorporeal, and by no means had a human form, because they argued such a constitution would involve the necessary accompaniment of human passions. Now this has been demonstrated by the ancient writers and especially Origen. Theophilus, however, though entertaining the very same opinion respecting the divine nature, yet to gratify his vindictive feelings, did not hesitate to pervert what he and they had rightly taught, but imposed upon the majority of the monks, men who were sincere but rude in speech, for the greater part of whom were quite illiterate. Sending letters to the monasteries in the desert, he advised them not to give heed either to Dioscorus or to his brothers, inasmuch as they affirmed that God had not a body. Whereas, said he, according to the sacred scripture, God has eyes, ears, hands, and feet, as men have. But the partisans of Dioscorus, being followers of Origen, introduce the blasphemous dogma that God has neither eyes, ears, feet, nor hands. By this sophism he took advantage of the simplicity of these monks, and thus a hot dissension was stirred up among them. Such as had a cultivated mind indeed were not beguiled by this plausibility, and therefore still adhere to Dioscorus and Origen, but the more ignorant who greatly exceeded the others in number, inflamed by an ardent zeal without knowledge, immediately raised an outcry against their brethren. A division being thus made, both parties branded each other as impious, and some listening to Theophilus called their brethren Originists, and impious, and the others termed those who were convinced by Theophilus anthropomorphity. On this account violent altercation arose, and an inextinguishable war between the monks. Theophilus, on receiving intimation of the success of his device, went to Nitria, where the monasteries are, accompanied by a multitude of persons, and armed the monks against Dioscorus and his brethren, who being in danger of losing their lives, made their escape with great difficulty. While these things were in progress in Egypt, John, bishop of Constantinople, was ignorant of them, but flourished in eloquence and became increasingly celebrated for his discourses. Moreover, he first enlarged the prayers contained in the nocturnal hymns, for the reason I am about to assign. Chapter 8. The Arians and the supporters of the Homusian hold nocturnal assemblies and sing antiphonal hymns, a species of composition ascribed to Ignatius, surnamed Theophorus. One conflict between the two parties. The Arians, as we have said, held their meetings without the city. As often therefore as the festal days occurred, I mean Saturday too and Lord's Day in each week, on which assemblies are usually held in the churches, they congregated within the city gates about the public squares, and sang responsive verses adapted to the Arian heresy. This they did during the greater part of the night, and again in the morning, chanting the same songs which they called responsive, they paraded through the midst of the city, and so passed out of the gates to go to their places of assembly. But since they did not desist from making use of insulting expressions in relation to the Homusians, often singing such words as these: "Where are they that say three things are but one power?" John, fearing lest any of the more simple should be drawn away from the church by such kind of hymns, opposed to them some of his own people, that they also employing themselves in chanting nocturnal hymns, might obscure the effort of the Arians, and confirm his own party in the profession of their faith. John's design indeed seemed to be good, but it issued in tumult and dangers. For as the Homusians performed their nocturnal hymns with greater display, for there were invented by John silver crosses for them on which lighted wax tapers were carried, provided at the expense of the Empress Eudoxia, the Arians, who were very numerous, and fired with envy, resolved to revenge themselves by a desperate and riotous attack upon their rivals. For from the remembrance of their own recent domination, they were full of confidence in their ability to overcome, and of contempt for their adversaries. Without delay therefore, on one of these nights, they engaged in a conflict, and Briso, one of the eunuchs of the empress, who was at that time leading the chanters of these hymns, was wounded by a stone in the forehead, and also some of the people on both sides were killed. Whereupon the emperor, being angered, forbade the Arians to chant their hymns any more in public. Such were the events of this occasion. We must now, however, make some allusion to the origin of this custom in the church of responsive singing. Ignatius VIII, third bishop of Antioch in Syria, from the apostle Peter, who also had held intercourse with the apostles themselves, saw a vision of angels hymning in alternate chants the Holy Trinity. Accordingly, he introduced the mode of singing he had observed in the vision into the Antiochian church, whence it was transmitted by tradition to all the other churches. Such is the account we have received in relation to these responsive hymns. Chapter 9. Dispute between Theophilus and Peter leading to an attempt on the part of the former to depose John, Bishop of Constantinople. Not long after this, the monks of the desert, together with Dioscorus and his brothers, came to Constantinople. There was also with them Isidore, one formerly the most intimate friend of the bishop Theophilus, but then become his bitterest enemy, on account of the following circumstance. A certain man named Peter was at that time the archpresbyter too of the Alexandrian church. Theophilus, being irritated against this person, determined to eject him from the church, and as the ground of expulsion, he brought the charge against him of having admitted to a participation of the sacred mysteries a woman of the Manichaean sect, without first compelling her to renounce her Manichaean heresy. As Peter in his defense declared, that not only had the errors of this woman been previously abjured, but that Theophilus himself had sanctioned her admission to the Eucharist, Theophilus became indignant, as if he had been grievously calumniated, whereupon he affirmed that he was altogether unacquainted with the circumstance. Peter therefore summoned Isidore to bear witness to the bishop's knowledge of the facts concerning the woman. Now Isidore happened to be then at Rome, on a mission from Theophilus to Damasus, the prelate of the imperial city, for the purpose of effecting a reconciliation between him and Flavian, bishop of Antioch. For the adherents of Meletius had separated from Flavian in detestation of his perjury, as we have already observed. 3. When Isidore had returned from Rome, and was cited as a witness by Peter, he deposed that the woman was received by consent of the bishop, and that he himself had administered the sacrament to her. Upon this Theophilus became enraged and in anger ejected them both. This furnished the reason for Isidore's going to Constantinople with Dioscorus and his brethren, in order to submit to the cognizance of the emperor, and John the bishop, the injustice and violence with which Theophilus had treated them. John, on being informed of the facts, gave the men an honorable reception, and did not exclude them from communion and prayers, but postponed their communion of the sacred mysteries, until their affairs should be examined into. Whilst matters were in this posture, a false report was brought to Theophilus's ears, that John had both admitted them to a participation of the mysteries, and was also ready to give them assistance, wherefore he resolved not only to be revenged on Isidore and Dioscorus, but also if possible to cast John out of his episcopal chair. With this design he wrote to all the bishops of the various cities, and concealing his real motive, ostensibly condemned therein the books of Origen merely, which Athanasius, for his predecessor, had used in confirmation of his own faith, frequently appealing to the testimony and authority of Origen's writings, in his orations against the Arians. Chapter 10. Epiphanius, bishop of Cyprus, convenes a synod to condemn the books of Origen. He moreover renewed his friendship with Epiphanius, one bishop of Constantia in Cyprus, with whom he had formerly been at variance. For Theophilus accused Epiphanius of entertaining low thoughts of God, by supposing him to have a human form. To now, although Theophilus was really unchanged in sentiment, and had denounced those who thought that the divinity was human in form, yet on account of his hatred of others, he openly denied his own convictions, and he now professed to be friendly with Epiphanius, as if he had altered his mind and agreed with him in his views of God. He then managed it so that Epiphanius by letter should convene a synod of the bishops in Cyprus, in order to condemn the writings of Origen. Epiphanius, being on account of his extraordinary piety a man of simple mind and manners, was easily influenced by the letters of Theophilus. Having therefore assembled a council of bishops in that island, he caused a prohibition to be therein made of the reading of Origen's works. He also wrote to John, exhorting him to abstain from the study of Origen's books, and to convoke a synod for decreeing the same thing as he had done. Accordingly, when Theophilus had in this way deluded Epiphanius, who was famous for his piety, seeing his design prosper according to his wish, he became more confident, and himself also assembled a great number of bishops. In that convention, pursuing the same course as Epiphanius, he caused a like sentence of condemnation to be pronounced on the writings of Origen, who had been dead nearly 200 years, not having this as his first object, but rather his purpose of revenge on Dioscorus and his brethren. John, paying but little attention to the communications of Epiphanius and Theophilus, was intent on instructing the churches, and he flourished more and more as a preacher, but made no account of the plots which were laid against him. As soon, however, as it became apparent to everybody that Theophilus was endeavouring to divest John of his bishopric, then all those who had any ill will against John, combined in calumniating him. And thus many of the clergy, and many of those in office, and of those who had great influence at the court, believing that they had found an opportunity now of avenging themselves upon John, exerted themselves to procure convocation of a grand synod at Constantinople, partly by sending letters and partly by dispatching messengers in all directions for that purpose. Chapter 11, of Severian and Antiochus, their disagreement from John. The odium against John Chrysostom was considerably increased by another additional event as follows. Two bishops flourished at that time, Syrians by birth, named Severian and Antiochus. Severian presided over the church at Gabala, a city of Syria, and Antiochus over that of Ptolemais in Phoenicia. They were both renowned for their eloquence, but although Severian was a very learned man, he did not succeed in using the Greek language perfectly, and so while speaking Greek he betrayed his Syrian origin. Antiochus came first to Constantinople, and having preached in the churches for some time with great zeal and ability, and having thus amassed 50 a large sum of money, one he returned to his own church. Severian, hearing that Antiochus had collected a fortune by his visit to Constantinople, determined to follow his example. He therefore exercised himself for the occasion, and having composed a number of sermons, set out for Constantinople. Being most kindly received by John, to a certain point, he soothed and flattered the man, and was himself no less beloved and honored by him. Meanwhile his discourses gained him great celebrity, so that he attracted the notice of many persons of rank, and even of the emperor himself. And as it happened at the time that the bishop of Ephesus died, John was obliged to go to Ephesus for the purpose of ordaining a successor. On his arrival at that city, as the people were divided in their choice, some proposing one person, and some another, John, perceiving that both parties were in a contentious mood, and that they did not wish to adopt his counsel, he resolved without much ado to end their dispute by preferring to the bishopric a certain Heraclides, a deacon of his own, and a Cypriot by descent. And thus both parties desisting from their strife with each other had peace. To now, as this detention at Ephesus was lengthened, Severian continued to preach at Constantinople, and daily grew in favour with his hearers. Of this John was not left ignorant, for he was promptly made acquainted with whatever occurred. Serapion, of whom we have before spoken, 3, communicating the news to him and asserting that the church was being troubled by Severian. Thus the bishop was aroused to a feeling of jealousy. Having therefore, among other matters, deprived many of the novations and quarto decimans of their churches, he returned to Constantinople. For here he resumed himself the care of the churches under his own especial jurisdiction. But Serapion's arrogance no one could bear, for thus having won John's unbounded confidence and regard, he was so puffed up by it that he treated everyone with contempt, and on this account also animosity was inflamed the more against the bishop. On one occasion when Severian passed by him, Serapion neglected to pay him the homage due to a bishop, but continued seated instead of rising, indicating plainly how little he cared for his presence. Severian, unable to endure patiently this supposed rudeness and contempt, said with a loud voice to those present, "If Serapion should die a Christian, Christ has not become incarnate." Serapion, taking occasion from this remark, publicly incited Chrysostom to enmity against Severian, for suppressing the conditional clause of the sentence, "If Serapion die a Christian," and saying that he had made the assertion that Christ has not become incarnate. He brought several witnesses of his own party to sustain this charge, But on being informed of this, the Empress Eudoxia severely reprimanded John, and ordered that Severian should be immediately recalled from Chalcedon in Bithynia. He returned forthwith, but John would hold no intercourse whatever with him, nor did he listen to anyone urging him to do so, until at length the Empress Eudoxia herself, in the church called the Apostles, placed her son Theodosius, who now so happily reigns, but was then quite an infant, before John's knees, and adjuring five him repeatedly by the young prince her son, with difficulty prevailed upon him to be reconciled to Severian. In this manner then these men were outwardly reconciled, but they nevertheless continued cherishing a rancorous feeling toward each other. Such was the origin of the animosity of John against Severian. Chapter 12. Epiphanius, in order to gratify Theophilus, performs ordinations at Constantinople without John's permission. Not long after this, at the suggestion of Theophilus, the bishop Epiphanius again came from Cyprus to Constantinople. He brought also with him a copy of the synodical decree in which they did not excommunicate Origen himself but condemned his books. On reaching John's church, which is 7 miles distant from the city, he disembarked, and there celebrated a service. Then, after having ordained a deacon, one, he again entered the city. In complaisance to Theophilus, he declined John's courtesy, and engaged apartments in a private house. He afterwards assembled those of the bishops who were then in the capital, and producing his copy of the synodical decree condemnatory of Origen's works, recited it before them, not being able to assign any reason for this judgment, than that it seemed fit to Theophilus and himself to reject them. Some indeed from a reverential respect for Epiphanius subscribed the decree, but many refused to do so, among whom was Theotimus, bishop of Scythia, who thus addressed Epiphanius. "Dash I neither choose, Epiphanius," said he, "to insult the memory of one who ended his life piously long ago, nor dare I be guilty of so impious an act as that of condemning what our predecessors did not reject, and especially when I know of no evil doctrine contained in Origen's books." Having said this, he brought forward one of that author's works, and reading a few passages therefrom, showed that the sentiments propounded were in perfect accordance with the orthodox faith. He then added, "Those who speak evil of these writings are unconsciously casting dishonor upon the sacred volume whence their principles are drawn." Such was the reply which Theotimus, a bishop celebrated for his piety and rectitude of life, made to Epiphanius. Chapter 13. The Author's Defense of Origen. 1. But since carping detractors have imposed upon many persons and have succeeded in deterring them from reading Origen, as though he were a blasphemous writer, I deem it not unseasonable to make a few observations respecting him. Worthless characters, and such as are destitute of ability to attain eminence themselves, often seek to get into notice by decrying those who excel them. And first Methodius, bishop of a city in Lycia named Olympus, labored under this malady. Next Astartheus, who for a short time presided over the church at Antioch, after him Aponeres, and lastly Theophilus. This quaternion of revilers has traduced Origen, but not on the same grounds, one having found one cause of accusation against him, and another another, and thus each has demonstrated that what he has taken no objection to, he has fully accepted. For since one has attacked one opinion in particular, and another has found fault with another, it is evident that each has admitted as true what he has not assailed, giving a tacit approbation to what he has not attacked. Methodius indeed, when he had in various places railed against Origen, afterwards as if retracting all he had previously said, expresses his admiration of the man, in a dialogue which he entitled Zenon. 2. But I affirm that from the censure of these men, greater commendation accrues to Origen. For those who have sought out whatever they deemed worthy of reprobation in him, and yet have never charged him with holding unsound views respecting the Holy Trinity, are in this way most distinctly shown to bear witness to his orthodox piety, and by not reproaching him on this point, they commend him by their own testimony. But Athanasius, the defender of the doctrine of consubstantiality, in his discourses against the Arians 3 continually cites this author as a witness of his own faith, interweaving his words with his own, and saying, the most admirable and assiduous Origen, says he, by his own testimony confirms our doctrine concerning the Son of God, affirming him to be coeternal with the Father. Those therefore who load Origen with opprobrium, overlook the fact that their maledictions fall at the same time on Athanasius, the eulogist of Origen. So much will be enough for the vindication of Origen. We shall now return to the course of our history. Dash.